That's right.
Unfashionably late.
All right. We're going to open up the Tuesday, May 16, 2017, House Committee on Veterans Affairs and Emergency Preparedness. And we're going to open up a public hearing on SJM 7 with Senator and Representative.
It's in the House.
Or whoever would like to start.
Mr. Chair and committee, thank you very much for hearing this bill. Name is Arnie Roblin. I'm senator from District 5, which goes from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and over into the valley in Fall City and Sheridan. We had a problem a few years ago when the federal government decided to cut back on their expenditures on the Coast Guard, and in doing so, put lives at risk on the coast. They have studies that they've done that show you've got a half hour, 45 minutes if you hit the water out here. Cold water rescues are usually cold water recoveries, not rescues. And when you take away the helicopter station, the only helicopter station out of the tsunami zone that's located in Newport, you extend the time to get to people from either Astoria or Coos Bay to about an hour to an hour and a half. So the chances of survival become much, much less. Most of the people that the Coast Guard ends up rescuing happen to be people who come visit the coast as opposed to our fishermen and others. They are kind of prepared. They do have equipment that can keep them alive a little longer in the water if they get on into it before they hit the water. The other one is we have, if you've seen the TV shows, we've got very dangerous conditions for our crabbing fleet that tends to go out in the ocean in the winter to collect crab. And we've got loggers up in the woods, both of whom use the facilities that the Coast Guard prepares to get people out after emergencies take place. And so a group of women came together called the Fishermen's Wives and put on a frontal attack at the federal government, went back there and talked to people, talked to every one of our legislators, brought all of us together, and turned that around last biennium and got the money for the Coast Guard. Again, we started hearing rumors that they were going to cut back on the Coast Guard. And what they do is they cut back on this particular place and also one in North Carolina. So we have continued to fight with everybody and make sure that if you really believe in the security of our nation, if you really care about taking care of Americans, then you should make sure that the Coast Guard is fully funded. And in particular, those life-saving facilities that are available on the coast need to be fully manned. The group that works in Newport comes out of the Coos Space Station, but they have a refueling station. What was really frustrating the last time is they had just repaired, put in new tanks, fixed up the whole station at Newport, and then they were going to say goodbye. We think that's a waste of money and resources and doesn't bode well for the emergencies that we see taking place on the coast, whether it be high winds or the tsunami and earthquake if it comes. So for us, this is a really integral part of the safety and viability of the coast and protecting not only the people who live there and work there, but also the people who visit there on a regular basis. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for your record, I'm David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast. And I'm also here today on behalf of the entire Coastal Caucus, which includes Senator Roblin, but is a bicameral and bipartisan group of legislators representing coastal districts. And for some of you, this memorial is going to look a little bit familiar because, in fact, 2 years ago, we passed something very, very similar. As Senator Roblin indicated, we were looking at cuts and a proposal to shut down the air station in Newport 2 years ago, and were able to compel the federal government to reverse that decision, which was actually quite a remarkable process. But here we are 2 years later, and the federal government is again looking at reductions in the Coast Guard budget, and that means that the air station in Newport is potentially at risk. Now, why is that important? At the risk of being a little bit redundant, as Senator Roblin indicated, we have three air stations in Oregon, one in Astoria, one in Newport, and one in the Coos Bay area. Interestingly, the one in Newport is the only one outside the tsunami inundation zone with the best potential to survive and support us in the aftermath of a major cascade event. But I'm looking in the more short term, and that is when they made a decision to look at reducing air stations, and they said we want to cut out Newport, they were basing that on a national study that said we should be able to respond to people in distress within 90 minutes. Well, I would say to you that that 90 minutes off the coast of Newport, Rhode Island is a lot different than 90 minutes off the coast of Newport Beach, California, and very, very different than 90 minutes in the cold waters off the coast of Newport, Oregon. Newport, Oregon, the home of the largest commercial fishing fleet in the state. But also just north is Depot Bay, the home of the largest charter fishing fleet in the state. And up and down the Central Coast, certainly one of the most popular tourism areas along the Central Coast. And that is where we have people who don't reside in Lincoln County or in the Central Coast, but coming from all over Oregon and coming all over the Northwest and the United States to visit our beaches and finding themselves, unfortunately, from time to time in riptides or slipping off cliffs into the water or being pulled in by sneaker waves. And that's when we need the Coast Guard to come out there and support us. Now, let me say that we've got an excellent group of first responders on the coast. The North Lincoln Fire and Rescue comes to mind, as do many of the other groups of first responders who tend to be the first ones there to get into the water and to go after people that are finding themselves in trouble when they're not on a fishing vessel many miles offshore. But the problem is that these folks putting their own lives at risk to help strangers need to have the Coast Guard looking over their shoulder should they get into trouble. And very often they are saying that we are going to be more hesitant to go into dangerous situations if the Coast Guard isn't nearby and available to help all of us should the situation turn worse. There's one other aspect of this that that we don't often think about, and that is that the Coast Guard doesn't only help people in the water, it also helps people in the woods. And our Coast Guard Air Station has a long and rich history of supporting the logging community throughout Oregon, pulling people out of injured workers out of very remote and difficult to access locations. So we're here once again sending a memorial to Congress. Colleagues, I'm not a big fan of memorials to Congress, but I think there are times when we need to go on record and send a message. And I believe this is one of those times. The Coast Guard saves lives. Cutting their budget will cost us lives, and it'll not only cost the lives of my constituents, potentially costing the lives of, unfortunately, your constituents as well. So let's send this message back east, and let's win this round a second time.
And just a short comment, and in August 21st, when it gets dark in the middle of the morning, Coast Guard will be there to help those people who get shook up that the sun has gone out. So we'd like to make sure that you're all there visiting the coast or sitting in Salem, where you can also see this wonderful event that's going to happen. Rarely in Oregon, but really right at the epicenter of Newport, Lincoln City, 10 o'clock in the morning or so on the 21st. So hope you'll all be there for the eclipse.
All right.
Happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for our panel?
Okay. Chair Evans, thank you, Chair Evans. Just a quick question. So this is a federal defense budget, right? And
Homeland Security.
Homeland Security.
They moved them from.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Which they say is really important, but they don't seem to fund the Homeland Security.
Yeah, this just seems counterintuitive there to that there, it continues to be on the chopping block, and still we have to send messages, but I'm in support of.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, sir.
So is this the last time we think that we'll be done with this and Congress will move on, or do we think
that's true?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lively, I certainly hope it's the last time, but if this becomes a question again in the future, we'll be back to reinforce the opinions and attitudes that we have shared.
Vigilance is important.
That's right, it is. Thank you.
Is it in the public hearing? Can you adjourn the action?
Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing.
Thanks
We're
so
going
much.
To open a work session on SJM 7.
Me too.
Would you please explain the bill so we can take a vote?
Thank you, Chairman Evans. Senator Roblin and Representative Gomberg thoroughly explained the SJM 7. Just to summarize quickly, the measure urges Congress to permanently and adequately fund and maintain United States Coast Guard Air Facility in Newport, Oregon. There was no fiscal impact, no revenue impact. The vote in the Senate was 29 ayes and 1 excused.
Eye
squeaker.
All right.
Photo finish.
Is there a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move SJM 7 to the floor with the B adopt recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves SJM 7 to the floor with a B adopted recommendation. Is there a discussion? No discussion? Seeing none? Yes, sir.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair, that having worked about 12 years in law enforcement on the South Oregon coast, I can attest to how important that air station is.
And, yes, sir.
There are oftentimes the Coast Guard cutters can't get there due to inclement weather, and it's really, really important to have that air ability.
Choppers there. I concur. All right. Sky, would you please call the roll?
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. Motion passes. And would Representative Gomberg like to carry this? Okay. Thank you. We're going to now move on to a public hearing on Senate Bill 850 Alpha. Please explain the bill. Let's see if there's anybody signed up to talk about it.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. Senate Bill 850A directs Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission to create volunteer committee or committees to assist with its work as specified, primarily to investigate issues related to provision of earthquake insurance to residential property owners and mass care and displacement. Directs agencies with subject matter expertise to offer supplemental staff support, requires report to State Resilience Officer by September 30th, 2018, sunsets January 2nd, 2019, declares emergency effective on passage. A little bit of history. The Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission, or the Earthquake Commission, otherwise called OSPAC, was established by Senate Bill 96 in 1991 to promote earthquake and tsunami awareness and preparedness. It is required to submit a report to the governor every 2 years, and in February of 2013, it issued the Oregon Resilience Plan. The plan exceeds 300 pages and contains more than 140 recommendations, emphasizing the importance of a sustained effort, perhaps over the course of 50 years, to make ongoing earthquake and tsunami preparations. Soon after the plan was released, the legislature enacted legislation creating a task force to study implementation of the plan and recommendations, and to prioritize issues for legislative action. The task force issued its recommendations in October of 2014, which led to the introduction of legislation during the 2015 legislative session to create the position of the State Resilience Officer to organize and centralize implementation efforts. Senate Bill 850A requires OSPAC to create committees to assist with its work on emergency preparedness issues, particularly in the areas of residential earthquake insurance and mass care and displacement, and report to SRO. There was a minimal fiscal impact statement issued. There was no revenue impact. The vote in the Senate was 28 ayes and 2 excused.
So when you say minimal, does that mean that it would need to go to Ways and Means, or is there not?
There is no subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay.
Minimal.
So I'm not,
I believe the correct criteria on that is it doesn't exceed $50,000.
Okay. All right. So we're going to invite up Mr. Harriman. While Mr. Harriman is coming up from the governor's office, I want to confirm. Mr. Kaiser, did you want to speak to this bill, or you have... On our agenda, we are going to be having an informational hearing about your business.
I think it's more informative.
Okay, so you do not need to come up for this bill.
Correct.
Okay, you're welcome to. I kind of figured it, you probably were just signing in because that was there. So, Mr. Harriman, why don't you tell us about the origin of this bill, and if you say it well enough, we might even be able to move it today.
Chair Evans. I'm Mike Harriman, the State Resilience Officer, and I'm very happy to be here. And as a veteran, I'm always honored to speak with this group and our Senate companion committee as well. So I'm neutral on the bill for one reason in particular. The bill entirely was not in the governor's budget. However, Senate Bill 109 was in the governor's budget, and it went over to the Senate side. Because it was a task force, it met an untimely stall. At the time, the Senate president did not want task force bills, new ones, because of whatever reason. Had we known that, we might have packaged this stuff up a little bit differently prior to session. I went to seek some advice from Senator Boquist on the Senate side, and he allowed his bill, Senate Bill 850, to be gut and stuffed. And so that is the genesis of 850A. 850A allows OSPAC, the State Commission on Seismic Policy Advisory that Mr. Volk just spoke about, to provide their statutory authority under 401.915, along with my statutory authority, 401.913, to bring together two work groups that at the end of the Oregon Resiliency Plan, this is the executive summary, was Chapter 9. And Chapter 9, 4 years ago, said looking ahead. Well, looking ahead is today. And in last February, in 2016, OSPAC made recommendations to the governor's office, the Speaker of the House, and the President's office on some next steps of implementation. One of them was to take a look at the California Earthquake Authority's model for home residents and earthquake insurance. The other was to look at mass care and mass displacement. By bundling these two pieces together to continue on the work of OSPAC and with the other agencies, we believe this is a great combination, and the first time we've used both the authority of the resilience officer and the authority of OSPAC to accomplish this task. I'd like to emphasize the fact that there's no fiscal on it, because under our state response plans, and with the what we believe the passage of Senate Bill 61A, which is going to expand the Oregon Emergency Response System to include up to 40 other state agencies along with the current 20, those state agencies have a direct role in planning and preparedness. So we think OSPAC, which we met again today here in Hearing Room 3, they provided support for this particular bill, 850A, on April 18th of this year at the Senator Boquist's committee. Their testimony is in OLIS, and they stand by their testimony in support of this. Also, the vice chair of the Oregon Resiliency Task Force, Jeff Rubin from Tualatin Valley Fire, in his role as the vice chair, also supported this this bill to move forward. We believe this is some things that are long overdue. We need to look at lessons learned, best practices, and really how these things all fit together. And I believe about 6 weeks ago I gave testimony one time to this committee about the Department of Homeland Security's resiliency assessment. I did submit that request to Homeland Security on April 18th of this year, and if selected, probably we'll know in the fall by Homeland Security, they'll do a two-year analysis of our resilience plan, our Cascadia playbook, and all the state plans focusing on mass care, public health, food, and water. And these are areas that I feel we're woefully inadequate, ready to prepare for, plan for, and respond to. So any work that we can do in this endeavor, I'd really appreciate it. State agencies will be tasked by myself under my statutory authority to participate and work with OSPAC, as in OSPAC already has six state agencies, and we have one state representative from this committee. Representative Boone has been assigned to the OSPAC committee here real recently, and Senator Roblin from the Senate side is also on the committee. So we have a state senator and a House of Representative staff or person to assist us during this process to look at these two particular things simultaneously but independent. And they'll produce a report, and I'd be the one coming back to this committee and Senator Boquist's committees to provide information on the report. So,
thank you, Mr. Herman. I have three questions, then I'll open it up for other questions. So I think these are yes-no questions. But first question is, though you can't support the bill in its current form because it wasn't in the governor's budget, effectively it would do what you were hoping to get done with that other bill. Yes?
Chair Evans, yes.
Second question is, the Senate committee thought enough of this task that they actually gave you a bill to get it done.
Chair Evans, yes.
Okay. Last question is, there's really no reason to wait on this. This should probably be done as soon as possible, right?
Chair Evans, yes.
Okay, great. Any other questions? Oh, I forgot. And thanks for the no fiscal. That helps, too. See, no questions? Okay. Would you like any other comments you'd like to add?
No, thank you very much.
Okay. Would anybody else like to add or subtract or come up and share? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing. I'd like to open a public here, open a work session on this bill, Senate Bill 850 Alpha.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 850A as an apple to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 850A as an apple to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, Sky, please call the vote.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. Motion passes. And who would like to carry this?
I'll carry it if you'd like, Mr. Chair.
I would like Vice Chair Esquivel to carry that, please. That'd be great. All right, thank you for that. We're going to now move on to, we're going to open an informational hearing. Mr. Kaiser and Mr. Conway, is that correct? We're going to start with you, and then we're going to... And Representative Helms certainly will be invited if you want to come up as well. We will do this, and then after about 20 minutes or so, we're going to bring up the Aries. I won't actually bring this up, but we do sometimes keep things about 20 minutes. Please come forward and tell us all about this very interesting product.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, State Rep. Ken Helm from District 34. Thank you so very much for scheduling this informational hearing. I wanted to bring this information to your committee because I'm so excited about it. I'll let my friends here tell you about the technology. It's truly innovative, and it's a safety system to actually provide safety for students in schools from a Cascadia subduction event. I'm proud of it because, number one, it's in my district. Number two, it's in my city, Beaverton. Number three, it's going to occur in the school that both of my kids went to school at when they were in elementary school. It's now the German International School of Portland. And these gentlemen and the principal of our school, Blake Peters, put this idea together themselves. There's no state involvement. There's no local involvement other than the local permitting process. The way this is, and most excitingly, all the local permitting through the city of Beaverton is now complete. All they're waiting to do is have school let out for the summer, and they can begin construction on this project. And that's really exciting. The permitting process went extraordinarily quickly because the engineering is so good, and the cooperation of the planning department in Beaverton and the applicant was so excellent. So I'm sort of bragging on my district, my city, and my school. I hope that you
always accepted.
I hope that you will remember this as we move forward to talking about how we make our public dollars go further. Ben, I think, shopped this idea around for a long time and shopped it to some public schools and public school districts and didn't get a bite. And I hope that when we finally get this project installed in the German International School and see that it will work and that it works well for cheap, for less money, that we may be able to have confidence to adopt it elsewhere in the state and maybe the nation. So I'll be quiet now, and again, thank you for having this informational session today.
You bet. Sirs?
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate that. My name is Ben Kaiser and
Paul Conway,
and I'm an architect and a general contractor in Portland, and I've been doing that for about 25 years.
And as Ken mentions, this to get to this point with the city of Beaverton has taken us about 4 to 5 years of work. And it's an interesting story, and I'll kind of take you through it quickly in this brief PowerPoint. And I'll go relatively fast, but just maybe in that speed, recognize that this has been a long, hard battle to get to this point. And Paul and I didn't realize we were turning such a large ship when we started this path. We thought the logic was so clear that it would be adopted pretty quickly within governments and public school systems. But as we all know, logic doesn't always apply to politics. And so it's been interesting to be a part of that. But so, Sky, Mike, what's interesting about Mike's presence here is we just returned from a week in Japan just a couple weeks ago. We went to northern Japan to study the effects of the earthquake and the resultant tsunami. And as many of you may know, Japan has about 10,000 earthquakes a year. So it's great to go over there and study how they've been dealing with these issues. But just to temper the discussion here in Portland a little bit, I have a little different view on it here for the state of Oregon. You can see here, I think this is very interesting, there's been about 3 deaths per year since 1811 resulting from earthquakes. The majority of the problem of earthquakes is the tsunamis or the fires or the other damage that occurs as a result of them. But the earthquake itself does not kill that many people. And I think it's just something we need to integrate into our thinking, is that they're not as damaging as the New Yorker article said last year, but everything west of I-5 would be toast. That's never happened in the history of the world, so it's a bit extreme in that thinking, and I think we need to pull back and apply a little more logic to that. And in fact, more people die from vending machines falling on them per year than from earthquakes. So it's just something to keep in mind. And then, so I've done plenty of seismic upgrades, full seismic upgrades of existing buildings over the year, and it struck me and the expense that we were spending on those, really what has to occur is to bring down a building, to damage a building. So a large earthquake has to hit that state, has to hit that city, has to hit that neighborhood, that street, that address, and then has to affect that particular URM. So the bet that we're placing as a state is enormous, that all those things will actually happen and result in the damage of a building. And earthquakes are very, very unknown science. So yes, we may have a very large one tomorrow, and we also might not have one for 400 years or so. So something to integrate again into our thinking. So core first, the idea, quite simple, it's just focusing your area of improvement on very small parts of the building. Full seismic upgrades, as you guys know, are very invasive, very expensive. They affect the entire building. You usually have to vacate a building in order to do it. And that's where the expense comes and the disruption of lead-based paint and all the other issues that are a result. Whereas this, as Ken mentioned, we're installing in about 50 days into a school during the summer months. So what it is essentially an engineered area that's dropped down into the hallways, usually of a building, so you pass through them all day. You get to acclimate as to what they are, where the protected part of the building is, and then move to that part of the building should an earthquake start. And also we have installed the first private early warning system in a building I did down in Northeast Portland. And so coupled with an early warning system, we feel that it's a wise way to upgrade a building without all the immense expense and disruption of a full seismic upgrade. And so getting deeper into the conversation over these last 4 years, as I mentioned, Paul and I were wondering why earthquakes are the only natural disaster that mobility is not part of the question, part of the solution. When in fact drop, cover, and hold, there's a lot of problems that are coming out of drop, cover, and hold. The Red Cross itself acknowledged to us that drop, cover, and hold has no substantive study proving its efficacy, which is interesting to me. So our whole country practices drop, cover, and hold, when the Red Cross itself, who is the author of the edict, recognizes there's really no study that says it's actually safe, that it actually protects lives, that it's actually protected lives. And there's also problems coming with the ADA. The ADA has questioned it regarding how can people in wheelchairs and the disabled get under desks. So they have a whole signage package trying to accompany the drop, cover, and hold. And then in Kathmandu, there was something unfortunate where the drop, cover, and hold was so strong, that edict, kids came off the playground, went into the building, got under the desk, and were crushed. So as we all know, desks don't protect people in collapsing buildings. So drop, cover, and hold may be very good for a bookshelf or a lighting package, but it's not good when a building collapses. And so we were wondering why, when everything else, every other natural disaster is a mobile response, where the building occupant adds to the solution, so that tornadoes, and so I grew up in the Midwest, no one would suggest to make the Midwest tornado-proof, but that's essentially how the earthquake code has gotten off onto a tangent, to make buildings earthquake-proof, even though every engineer would recognize that you can't make buildings earthquake-proof. You can do something that you think will improve the building, but there's no way to make a building earthquake-proof. So, and there's no way to make a building tornado-proof. Fires, there's no way to make buildings fireproof. So we add mobility to the solution. People move out with warning systems and exit the building, as they do with tornadoes. When there's a warning, they move to a safe part of the building. Fires, they leave the building. Of course, tsunamis and hurricanes and flooding, they leave the building. They leave. And it's interesting, too, what Mike and I, and Mike would probably concur, is that in that large earthquake in Tohoku, a very small percentage died in the earthquake. It was the thousands that died in the tsunami. So you don't really want to have a static response in an earthquake when really the bigger impact will be the tsunami that's right behind it. So we feel that you should keep mobility in the conversation right from the beginning. And then, and this is an interesting... faking, they decided that.
That way.
Always a left move. Building. Also, what I think is very interesting is tornadoes and earthquakes act very similarly. They have a path of destruction that's not whole. Doesn't bring down whole towns. Doesn't bring down cities. An earthquake acts very similar, where there's tornado destruction right next to unaffected structures. Same in earthquakes. And the earthquakes act this way because it depends on the soil types beneath these buildings. So buildings on firm soil can or cannot be affected, and buildings on liquefiable soil, even if it's fully upgraded, can completely sink. So how do you deal with a solution when really an earthquake acts exactly like a tornado, kind of what finding its way? This is in Kathmandu, very old city, of course. Parts collapse, parts are unaffected, right next to each other, right across the street from one another. This is a video showing that difference. I won't waste your guys' time with it, but what it shows is that even a fully upgraded building on liquefiable soil, a brand new building on liquefiable soil, will sink. And it has no ability to resist the earthquake's effects. And as we all know, any building to any upgrade in a tsunami zone will also be inundated. So again, the soil types are very important. This goes into a bit of a background on the early warning system. Early warning systems are successful in Japan. On the recent trip that Mike and I were on, everybody was attesting to the success of the Japanese early warning system. They're also in Mexico, in Turkey, they're throughout the world. We're a little behind here in the States, but they're private systems, as I mentioned. We've installed one ourselves. It's already successfully located two earthquakes in the Tillamook Forest, and that's in our building. It's about a $75,000 system, and it would have given, in our building, about 40 seconds of a warning. And so we have proof of that. This is interesting. This is just the proof of P and S waves, what they are. The P and S waves that early detection systems rely on. This dog will sense the wave well before the people, And that's exactly how these detection systems work. So this dog, it's really interesting video. Just sitting there.
Oh.
He leaves.
Yeah.
Then the earthquakes, the weakened field starts. PNS waves act the exact same way. And what this video also proves to us is that, again, this was a large earthquake in Los Angeles. People travel great distances and choose travel over immobility every time. See the dog, everybody makes it out of the building during a major earthquake. So that's, we're just proponents, again, of moving through and out of a building. Do not wait under a desk. Do not wait for the fires. Do not wait for the tsunamis. Do not wait for the other damaging occurrences. This is a brief video of the installation Shake Alarm.
Shake Alarm is a robust and affordable commercial-grade earthquake early warning system that can be installed in any new or existing building, facility, or campus.
Where it's installed.
A number of sensors are embedded in the earth around the perimeter of the facility. These sensors are able to detect the incoming faster-moving primary waves and distinguish them from the slower-moving property-damaging secondary waves. Cables are installed connecting these buried sensors to the monitoring and display equipment. The cables connect to the data acquisition and processing unit on site. This unit instantly analyzes and characterizes the seismic signals in terms of the building's structural strength. The system is always ready to analyze seismic activity to determine when emergency protocols need to commence. The trigger point is preset and depends upon the structural characteristics of the building being protected. In the event of an impending earthquake, Shake Alarm provides critical advance warning to building occupants. Shake Alarm, a life and asset-saving earthquake early warning system from Weir Jones, offered exclusively in the United States by Core First.
And again, this has been successfully used up in Canada for years. This is a number of, again, to prove that people choose movement, and throughout Japan, no one stays under a desk. I'll show you just a couple of interesting things. This is a great video, and again, when you guys have a little time, you can watch it. Here, I'll go to...
The buildings are damaged. In Tokyo, a ceiling collapses on a college graduation ceremony, killing two people and injuring 25.
Glad I told us to get the
That's
out of
exactly
here.
Where we
That's
were.
Where we just were.
Just some people did.
Whoever the students were just there, and they decided to move. And the people that decided not to move were crushed by the ceiling. And that's not the building. That's just the part of the ceiling that crushed the people under the desk. So again, we're proponents not to be under desks. We're proponents to move to the safety of Core First, but then eventually out of the building. Out of the building is the objective, not underneath the desk. So it's really, it's a, why back
to the...
Don't know what that is. Where that logic that we were talking about, try to... Or tsunami shots. So that logical approach that I thought Paul and I was going to be such an easy kind of thing to accomplish for us, the installation of these into schools. We started with Portland Public Schools. It got a little political in the home stretch, and so they backed away from it. And it was due to a bond that they had about to be voted on back a couple of years ago. But really what we see is that the logical place always in an earthquake is to be out of the building, especially these old unreinforced masonry buildings. And so Core First really is a place that you move to, always with the end game being outside of the building, like you are in fires, tornadoes, tsunami, everything else. You want to be out of the building. So we're a little confused why code got off on this path where you you stay under a desk for a while. And also what's interesting, as you guys all may be aware, is that there's a lot of confusion in the city of Portland and across the state is what buildings have and have not been upgraded. And one thing Core First is clear about, as you saw in that representation, is that you'll know exactly where the part of the building that has been made secure. And what's also interesting is that secure part is stronger, about 120% stronger than a brand new building. Because again, we can focus on such a small area, you're actually safer in that than you are in a building built to today's code. And no seismic upgrade on an existing building gets anywhere near that safety factor.
So, yep. Chair and Representative Paul Conway, I just wanted to add that there are precedents for what, when we were researching if there was anything to validate what we're proponents for in other countries, what would that be? In Mexico, Chile, Turkey, they will have engineers go into buildings and find the safest areas within a building and say, as soon as that shaking starts, get there. And they also have the earthquake early warning technology there. So there is a precedent for what we're proposing.
And as Ken says, we're now permitted and start construction in a couple months, which we're excited about. And we're also in talks with OMSI up in Portland. They're interested in the possibility of installing one of these and having an early warning system to teach the children really what it's all about. And I think the whole premise is that this is about 20% of the cost of an upgrade, a full upgrade. And right now, Portland is crippled by the fact that the codes are getting more and more onerous, but no one can afford to do anything. So the result is no one's doing anything. And I think what Paul and I thought is that if you can get it economically feasible, people will start to implement it. So objectively, you could do 5 times as many schools, 5 times as many buildings for the exact same cost. And I know in a state that we're always struggling with our budgets, that's the best approach.
Ben, can you talk real quickly about what's in the Core First structure? Because it's not just a superstructure. There's first aid, and there's food and water, and
yeah,
there's training on how to get there.
Thank you. These cores have a backup lighting system and a backup water system, so they're essentially true sanctuaries. So in the event of an earthquake, the warning system will detect the earthquake coming. The lights will turn on in these cores. They'll have a backup water system as well, because that usually ruptures in an earthquake and leaves the building rendered unable to fight a fire. So these things are acting as sanctuaries in any number of events. It could be, it's definitely designed for an earthquake, but it would be there for any other issue that arises in a school equipped with first aid and other such things.
Thank you. There's a couple of things I'd like to address and then open it up for questions. The first is, I think your product is very intriguing, and the idea of sanctuaries makes a lot of sense. That said, comparing to Japan, which is the most prepared country on the planet, I'm not certain that everything will be as hunky-dory here as it will be there during most of the earthquakes, because they've been preparing for a lot longer than we have. So in your opening comments, I absolutely agree that we shouldn't be panicked, but we should be prepared.
I agree.
And that my concern is not so much the actual earthquake as the 3 to 6 months afterwards, mm-hmm. which is what we're trying to focus on. So as you continue to talk about this cost savings and life savings, just because we haven't had a major disaster that's cost hundreds of thousands of lives doesn't mean that that still couldn't happen.
I totally agree.
So I just want to make sure not to take people off the preparedness.
No, I agree, and I think that's, and we don't mean to do that. We just need to, I think the intent is to find a balance of those,
right.
The unknown with the potential.
Right, and the idea of giving people something that they actually can do about it is a whole lot more focused. So thank you for bringing that forward.
May we enter a document for the
sure.
committee?
Sure. Just give it to Sky, and we'll put it in the record.
Okay,
absolutely.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I find this very interesting and offers a lot of opportunities. But one of my concerns, so many of the buildings, what we know in this state as we've looked at them, are old brick buildings, in that the likelihood of them standing very long is pretty slim. And the whole idea of the retrofits is to keep them from falling so fast that, and again, to allow the opportunity for people to get out. But the other risk comes with so many of the buildings is, so if we allow an opportunity for people to get out, much of what I've seen about earthquakes is what falls on people when they go outside. And I'll pick my house for an example, which has a tile roof. Just a little shaker we had years ago, some of those tiles slid off that roof. If I'd have been out, going out that door at that time, that's probably what would have killed me. The house didn't collapse, but the tile roof is. And so I'm trying to understand, so if we create this safe environment, but our goal is to get people out, so what's kind of the protocol about when does a person, or how do they make that decision? You had the early warning that may get them into the safer location, but then what's the next step in this process, depending on what's happening with the building, in getting them out of there?
Great question, Representative Lively. So what's interesting about that is that the same problem exists even if you haven't touched the building,
right,
or even if you have touched the building, right? Because you'll still always have to leave a building, drop, cover, and hold, fully upgraded. So we're proponents of, with Core First, we also seismically protect all the exit ways.
Okay.
So that the parapets, the brick facades are tied with helical ties. So we make sure that the exit ways and Core First are done at the same time.
Okay.
We would never do just Core without those, because I agree that that's the part that is potentially damaging. Mm-hmm. But what we're a little confused by is the drop, cover, and hold paradigm leaves it up to substitute teachers, right, or whomever to make the decision when to get up during aftershocks, fires, tsunamis, and do all that travel regardless. So you still have the problem of,
right,
leaving the building. And you've left it up to someone with very little training on when, how, which route. We've kind of stopped at the premise of drop, cover, and hold. We have no follow-up to all the issues behind drop, cover, and hold. So we're thinking that the idea of mobility from beginning to end is a better training mechanism to get to the eventuality of being outside. And so with that in mind, the outside of the parapets.
Great. Thank you.
The stop, cover, the stay in place, shelter in place, may actually be a legacy to accounting and personnel management more than survivability. If everybody's there, then you have them accounted for. You don't have to try to figure out where they're at.
Yeah, that's true.
And there are some lessons from the fire service with the new passport systems, or I guess not so new now, but with tracking people so that during an event you theoretically could manage that flow easier, which may be part of the conversation in schools. Certainly worth discovery, though. Other questions, comments? All right. Well, first of all, thank you very much for coming.
If I may add one more thing, Representative Lively, Blake Peters of the German International School, he's working with emergency management in Beaverton to figure out where to go,
right,
and to have a meeting point so that there is communication and,
sure,
you know, being able to figure out that we got everybody out.
Do your Core First facilities include some type of radio system?
It's a great question. Again, we've talked a lot about that.
As we have a ham radio operator right in the front row.
Yeah, I'm anxious to hear that. We've actually talked about integrating that into the system, but as you know, the objective is to get the cost to where people can do it. But those are all easily upgradable features afterwards. So.
Well, thank you very much for bringing this forward. This is great.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time today.
We expect a phone call at some point for more questions after this to see how we can try to get the conversation moving in the right direction.
I appreciate it. Appreciate
thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
We're going to close the informational session on CORE first, and now we're going to open the informational session on ARES. And Mr. CORE, would you like to come forward?
CORE. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is John CORE. I'm the Oregon Section Manager for the American Radio Relay League, the National Association of Amateur Radio, and I'm pleased to be here with you again today.
Welcome back.
To talk about amateur radio and disaster preparedness, disaster communications, and some important thoughts that I think I can share with you on this issue. Let me just give you a little bit of background on me. I was licensed in 1970 and joined the Amateur Radio Emergency Service back in 2001, like many people did, because I wanted to be of service to the people of Oregon. Since that time, I've served at the county and state level. For 6 years, I was the guy that coordinated two simulated emergency tests within the state of Oregon that we hold every year. We still do that. We just finished one April 22nd. This usually involves about 20 counties and about 300 volunteers from around the state every time we do these. And I was fortunate to be able to work with everybody. I read all these reports. How did it go? What worked? What didn't? So with that kind of a background, I found myself involved with Oregon Emergency Management. I work with Oregon Emergency Management Association. And I was very involved in Cascadia Rising. And I hope all of you know about Cascadia Rising, and I hope all of you have read the after-action reports from OEM on what they found. Because I think that was really kind of a turning point in this issue. Prior to that, if I look back at it, there were some significant events that happened that affect how we see this issue. The first was 9/11, when many amateur radios were on the air using communication methods that when the police and fire couldn't talk to each other, the hams could. And when Katrina came along, it was the same thing. It was a massive effort by the ham radio people to provide communications when everything fell apart on the authorities. And that's happened time and time and time again. So the way we begin to see amateur radio is not so much as just a hobby anymore. This is becoming somewhat serious stuff. And so one of the thoughts that I have is, as I would hope that the committee and the emergency managers, all of us involved in this issue, it's a partnership between all of us. We've got to stop looking at this as a hobby and start getting serious about this, which is why I'm glad to be with you here today, because this is a very unique forum. In all the years I've worked on this at OEMA and other meetings, there really hasn't been a state perspective on amateur radio and emergency communications. There hasn't anybody, nobody plans for it. Nobody really coordinates it on a state level. And so those are some of the things that I think we really need to be thinking about here. So if you read those reports from OEM, what you will see is that, in short, communications is everything. You've got to have communications. When one of these events happens, in the days and weeks thereafter, if you haven't got communications one way or another, it's a big, big problem. During Cascadia Rising, the first day there was a blackout, normal communications blackout, where the only means of communications was by ham radioed out to the counties. And I'm pleased to say that that went very well. It went very well. And FEMA was happy. OEM Director Phelps recognized those efforts.
Sir, I have a question, if I could. We, in 2008, when I was working for Governor Kongoski, we spent about $200,000 on radio upgrades so that the counties and others could have that equipment.
That's right.
Is that equipment still relevant? Did it play a role?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That revolutionized amateur communications. Although that radio equipment went out to the counties, we use it at OEM.
And that program has been working?
It's working very well.
Okay.
Very well. Probably 90% of the message traffic between OEM and the counties goes through that the radio systems that money bought, that $250,000.
Okay.
That was back in 2008.
Right.
Now it's 2017. And one of the things I want to highlight is that there really hasn't been any future planning on where do we go from here. How do we even keep what we've got in place working?
Right.
And performing well, because we're several generations of radio technology behind, and so we need to think about that. So it's that's important, and I hope you put your hourglass up there. I will try to honor your time commitments.
It's not an exact science.
I tried to kind of focus my talk today on the issues that you identified in a correspondence from back in February, to identify stakeholders, look at existing capabilities, realistically, try to find some priorities and then find some way to move forward with all of this. So this presentation and the written materials that I provided to you are along that line. So we know from Cascadia Rising and from the studies that FEMA have done is that the majority of communications are going to be out in Western Oregon for a period of days to weeks. Of course, nobody really knows, but that's a critical time period for life-saving and to begin the power of getting the process of restoring communications and getting things up to running. So there will be about 10 million people that don't have communications west of I-5, which Ken Murphy from FEMA Region 10 described as the area which would be toast, somewhat famously. And to further that even that bigger problem, OEM found that there wasn't an effective means of communicating with the public during this time period, that the methods that they normally use were not being effective. So now they're looking at using amateur radio for that purpose, and I've been working with them on that. So they have said that amateur radio may be the only reliable means of communications, as I mentioned. But on the other hand, we were always intended to be a backup communications provider, not the primary provider. So for a period of a few days, we can provide it be in that role. If this extends very long, then we've really got problems. There's just too few of us. There is a huge demand for this service that I could go into further. And so we need to find a way to recruit more people into public service and to increase our capabilities, and we've got to find ways to train and drill and engage these people in this task. So what are the existing capabilities? Well, as you mentioned, the funds provided by Governor Kulongoski were used very effectively and are still in use today. We rely on that quite heavily for county level to state communications. We have field operations that we've done that can run for 24 hours on these simulated emergency tests, and about, as I mentioned, about 300 volunteers in somewhere in around 20 to 25 counties that get involved in these activities. So the radio gear that we've got now, we've demonstrated that we can deliver about a message a minute into OEM on that system. And they had to get a bigger printer because they couldn't print the messages that were coming in fast enough. Now the problem is, and the hurdle we got to get over is that we print those things off the printer, we hand them to a liaison in the ECC in the big room there at OEM. They sort those out by county. This is going to Lincoln County. That one's going to Coos County. And then those go out to the counties and to the various factors. So if you've got a power issue, the power is out in Lincoln County, that'll go to the guy in the ECC that's coordinating all of the power issues for the state. So it goes kind of a central coordinator. But we can just, those folks are so overloaded in information. And we're handing them a printed piece of paper. It's on a standard ICS form, so it's easy to read. It's got signatures on it, dates, and all this stuff. But they're so buried in that the amount of traffic that comes out of that room and goes back to the originating party is very limited. There's a long time lag. The emergency managers really expect, when they send a message, they expect to get a reply like that. And they get concerned when, what happened to my message? Did they get it? What's the answer? And, you know, so working through that process of working with the emergency managers is an issue. And OEM recognizes that. This is not, I'm not telling you anything that they don't know. So there are efficiencies that, of course, that are needed. So I wanted to talk about these various areas of the issue: governance, training, volunteers, and the radio equipment, and some new technologies I think you ought to know about. One of the questions was about stakeholders. Who are the stakeholders in this? Well, we have radio systems in many of the county EOCs. The counties have funded radio systems in the state, in the city EOCs. So the city of Portland has their own system. City of Beaverton has a amateur radio system. Hillsborough does, and so on. So there's all those government entities. And then you have all the hospitals are getting into this. And in a number of different areas around the state. In the Portland area, Portland metro area, just as an example, Providence has amateur radio capabilities. Kaiser wants to develop it. Legacy hospitals, I just talked to them the other day. They called me up and they said, we need to develop our radio plan for all of our hospitals. And we've got to figure out how this works. We don't know anything about this. We need your help in figuring out what's the plan, what equipment do we buy, how do we train people, how do we sustain this kind of an operation. So each of these hospitals, this is a big job. So Portland General Electric has their own system. They have for some years. Bonneville Power is now developing it. ODOT has contacted me probably 2 years ago to try to get amateur radio and some of their equipment. A number of community colleges have it. Reed, Willamette University, a number of others have it. The community emergency response teams that were working with the Beaverton folks at Beaverton High School, they all use amateur radio and radio into the city EOC, which radios information into the county. If a county needs to send it to state OEM, they do that on the governor's equipment that's purchased. That's kind of the flow of the traffic. Red Cross, all these other groups that you see on here. There's a lot of them, and there are more of them. Most recently, I got contacted by the director of the Oregon Department of Aviation. He says, I got to have communications with the 28 airports in the state of Oregon. So if I have to fly relief supplies and people into the coast or into central Oregon, or, you know, I have to know what the status of that airport is and what's happening there. And he doesn't feel he has that. If he loses those communications, he just doesn't know. During Cascadia Rising, I happened to be there. I was handed a message from aviation. They wanted to know the status of airports in Lincoln City. We handed that off to the Lincoln City people. We got them on the radio, sent the message report on your status of your airport, and that took about 4 days to get that answer back. And the aviation folks kept coming into the radio room and said, "Did you get our answer yet? Did you get it?" "No, haven't got it yet." Finally, it came in. So that's a critical problem that we have to start looking at those kinds of coordinate issues. So there's a lot of people involved in this.
Yep.
And it's one of the problems here is that we just don't have a common forum to talk about this and coordinate all these programs. Amateur Radio Emergency Service, which is the group that I work with, has folks in perhaps 20 counties in the state, but there are also other groups, many other groups,
sure,
that are not members of the Amateur Radio Emergency Service.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know how many of the county emergency management agencies are making or have a network for amateur radio, and what about Oregon Emergency Management?
At the county level, I would say maybe 15 or 20. And when you get into eastern Oregon, there's nothing
what
going on out there.
What about the coast? You know, what about the coast region?
In the valley, all of them do. I think by law, all of them have an emergency manager or emergency coordinator. Some of them have strong systems, like Multnomah, Washington County, have a lot of people, and it's a big deal.
on the coast as well?
Yes.
Okay, so.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, some much larger than others.
Right.
But the coast is critical.
Yep.
The coast is critical. But any of them would say they don't have enough people. They don't have enough training. They don't have enough equipment. Equipment's getting somewhat aged. So there is a way, I think, to, if there's a way to get people together to discuss about this issue, what should the planning be? What frequency plan should we use? What kind of training? Maybe there's some joint training programs everybody can use. And we need to develop a lot stronger relations between the emergency managers and the hams. Up till quite recently, it's been the hams are a bunch of ham guys, and they do their thing, and the emergency managers do theirs, and there's not enough coordination. But we all recognize that's a problem. But we need to work on that. We need, of course, more volunteers. And this is probably the biggest problem we've got. There are 18,000 amateurs in the state. About 3% of those, about 600 in that area, are in amateur radio, emergency service, or other forms of public service in one degree or another. Those folks are scattered around the state. About a third are in the Portland metro area, more or less, and the rest are up and down the valley. When you get into eastern Oregon, there are very, very few, one or two people. And that's a critical area, especially in central Oregon, because that's where all the relief is going to be piling up. So we got to have communications between the valley and the coast and into the Bend Redmond area.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know in Jackson County that they have a certain day that they do, the ham radio operators do an emergency rehearsal of some kind. Is that any affiliated? Is that affiliated with state, or is it just the club doing it, or what is that?
Sarah Rubrick, the emergency manager in Jackson County, who I know very well, has a group of volunteers down there that work with her, and they participate in those drills that you're talking about.
Does that mean they set them up in fields? They set them up in you know, any place? They set these things up and they're mobile.
Yeah.
And they can move them from place to place to place.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they'll go out in tents, trailers, whatever, and communicate between themselves within the county, and then from the county to back into OEM, back to the state. So yeah, that's what we do. We organize those things, and we have been for some years. And we need to get more people to play in them. Not all the counties do. It's some do, some don't.
So to that point, and again, we have about another 10 minutes. How much does a set cost right now?
How much does it cost?
A good radio set that would be good enough to be used in an emergency situation.
Oh, well, I think the systems that are in each of the county EOCs were probably in the area of $10,000 or $15,000.
So if there was a way to have a incentive system of some type, tax credit, tax deduction, state buys you the equipment, but you have to maintain it, whatever it may be, among the 18,000 amateurs that are out there that have the ability to use the equipment, et cetera, what amount percentage do you think could be perhaps incentivized to actually get involved because the equipment is made cheaper for them to use?
I don't think that's the issue.
Okay.
Equipment is not the issue. I think a lot of folks don't want to commit to the training, the meetings. They want their independence. A lot of them are older retired folks. And you know, we need to change, I think, the kind of the image around amateur radio.
Okay.
A lot of them just don't want to get involved in the politics, so they don't want to get involved in the.
But we'd prefer them not in the politics too. We just want them to be available.
Yeah, you appreciate that. But some of them, they don't want a background checks. All of our folks are background checks. Some of them don't want to do that. That's understandable. That's fine. They have that privilege. They don't want background checks. But I think we need to figure out a way that we can help the image of the amateur radio and public service folks and build a more positive view of all of this stuff.
Representative Meek, you had a question before I interrupted?
Well, yeah, thank you, Chair Evans. Well, my question was right along to the volunteers and the 18,000. How do you know that there's 18,000? Are they somehow licensed? Or are they registered?
Yeah. Those are the number of licensed, FCC-licensed amateurs in Oregon, 18,300.
Okay, so quite a few. And my guess is that I think if we've reached out or come up with some kind of an incentive to be trained or, you know, let them know how they could help with the readiness, that maybe we can get if we got 10% more or whatever, that would be more than where we're at now. So,
yeah.
I don't know what you thought about that.
Okay. Yeah. I think some simple things would help. For example, I know in the state of Washington they have a ham radio week that the governor declares ham radio week, you know, just simple things like that that make people take notice that these folks are engaged in public service.
We can give 2 weeks.
They're important.
Yeah.
The state of Oregon doesn't do that. I think it would be wonderful if that were to happen. Just simple things like
the recognition
that can elevate the public service and get people want to be involved in it.
Okay.
So are these people in a club? Is that what they're in? Kind of a radio club?
Well, some of them are in radio clubs. The majority are not. The recent trend that you may have seen is that people get licensed because they want a radio in case there's an emergency. And they buy a radio, and they put it in a drawer, and that's the end of that.
Follow up.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, during an emergency, who's going to check your license?
Well, that's the theory. But the problem is that if you just buy the radio, you don't know how to run it.
Right.
The batteries are probably not any good, and it's not effective. In fact, I know a school district that I won't name that has 40 ham radios that they bought for school district emergency management that have never been used.
And never used them?
Never used them because they don't know how to use them. And they've never been programmed or...
How close to this building is that school district?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
Now, you've got... I provided this basically all the information here in a written document that you can read through, but I think in light of the time, the critical thing here is that from a public perspective, service perspective, and when you're looking at Cascadia events, or if you're looking at a massive hack attack on the grid, which is another big problem, mm-hmm. you got to have some form of reliable or somewhat reliable communications. And right now, amateur radio seems to be the focus of that activity. So we've got to do what we can to bring more people in, improve the image of this thing, upgrade the equipment, get us back to where we were back in 2008, at least, if not advance the technology. We really ought to be advancing the technology. There's some new ideas, some new high-speed data transmission techniques that we can use really would be wonderful. They effectively replace internet. It's just entirely separate wireless network on amateur radio frequencies. It's high-speed data, and it's used in California and other communities. It's known technology, and this is a big issue for OEM. If you're familiar with they use Web EOC, other electronic systems, from the Raptor system that they have. If the internet goes down, they can't trade data with the other EOCs. But if you had a system like this, a high-speed data system, they could just switch over to that network.
Right.
And that wouldn't be hacked because it's not part of the normal network. It's entirely independent. So it's something that we're thinking about and talking about. And that's why I was engaging this idea of a forum for people to get together and talk about it. Because this is a very unique forum. This has never been done before, as I say. So I really appreciate your interest and your forethought.
So, So speaking on behalf of the committee to try to help move this forward for the capacity issue, what would you need, or would you be willing to help provide a draft concept for what a forum, the players, the location, what would be the Cadillac version, what would be the Chevy version, and we won't go below the Chevy version, but what you need and what you would want to have the kind of dialogue necessary so we can actually support the work group to be able to determine and develop what investments may be necessary, what training options may be necessary, what recognition programs could be implemented. I mean, I know that the power of communication will make or break our response to a crisis in the after effect, and to the extent that, quite frankly, this is one of the cheapest investments in terms of systems that we evidently haven't been investing in even as much as we should have.
Yeah.
But for the return on investment, it's incalculable. So would you be interested in trying to give us some idea of what we can help you with?
I anticipated that you would.
Okay.
You might be heading that direction. And I can't say that I have it all laid out today. That's exactly the kind of thing we need. I was hoping that Representative Post and his work group would be able to bring together a group of folks that would do that, and of course we would participate in that. So it's a matter of timing and when you might need it. And
would it have to be a traveling show?
Would it need to be a traveling show, or could there be one forum and then follow-ups after that, or do you envision a roadshow approach?
I think probably the best way to do it, in my mind, is to come up with some kind of a straw man proposal that people can react to, and then get some input from the emergency managers, OEM, other people like that. That's
Representative Post. Let us know what we can do to help you and John put this together, and the interest of the hospitals may in fact provide some of the hospitals have a community of a requirement for community investment and community support. This could be done in a partnership way to make sure that the technology and the training is made available as a part of their mission in addition to the other things we're doing. So there may be some ways to develop some creative partnerships to get that accomplished. What's a fair timeline, do you think, for the proposal?
Tomorrow? Are we talking during session or interim?
Not to implement the proposal during session, but to basically have the plan for the forum that we could talk about so that by the end of session we could actually get people
make
together.
Make a recommendation.
So maybe we can talk about that today, and Representative Post and I can talk about it. Then I think we need to get some other folks engaged in this.
Whoever else you need, and we will engage the governor's office to, number one, start thinking about a week for radio like Washington has, and getting the, the State Resilience Officer, and I were talking about this before, that he knows the capability and the value of your organization. So I know that he would support, use his office to support it as well. Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
Other questions or comments?
We will talk.
How many folks right now are in your team at OEM?
I'm sorry, are in what?
At OEM.
Yeah.
How many are in your team right now as far as...
This highlights the issue. OEM right now has a group called the State Communications Unit that works at OEM that is staffed by volunteers from Oregon Emergency or in radio emergency service. The number of folks that have been available to do that have gone down over the last few years, so that now that there's just a handful of people. Not nearly enough. In fact, for Cascadia Rising, we had to bring in people from the coast, from Portland area, up from Corvallis to staff that for 4 days. Now, in a real event, we couldn't get there.
Right.
And that's another issue.
Okay. Well, thank you.
That's why we need more people.
Representative Post, would you like to add anything?
No, I well, other than that, I was fascinated by page 13, the idea of high-speed data on wireless networks, of course, as an alternative to internet. We had one bill earlier this year that was somewhat connected to this. I don't think it ever went anywhere, but that's just another. That's all. Page 13 intrigues me. So, I'd like to see how we can get that done, but that's a big issue.
Chair Evans, I had just one question. On the slide, you had said that there would be 10 million people without communications west of I-5. Does that include Washington and California?
Did I get that number wrong?
And I was just, because I know Oregon, just the state of Oregon has 4 million people.
That's from the resiliency plan. That's where I got that. Without communications. Power and internet. That's power and internet. That was from the resiliency plan of 2013.
Washington or Oregon, both.
And so I don't know about that number. I have to go back and research that.
Yeah.
It would probably be from the full fault line, which is
right.
A little bit of Washington,
the Cascadia
a lot of California.
Event. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But thank you very much.
We're glad to do what we can to help you. This is an important issue for us.
And we
thank you.
Our commitment of the committee is we will help find a way to make that forum happen. So coming into the short session, we have a list of things that we can try to get done. Okay?
Well, we'll talk to Representative Post here and
looking forward to
what
the,
we can do.
Looking forward to the outcomes. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to close the informational hearing. And any other business before the committee? All right. We will have
Tuesday.
We are meeting Thursday. We've got a couple of vets bills up, and we may be pushing Senate Bill 143 down the road just a little bit for one more amendment, but we're going to perhaps not do that. So we want to make sure and not get it stuck. So we will be having committee on Thursday, but it should be relatively short. Have a wonderful rest of your day. We are now adjourned.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks. Thank you. Rest of your day. We are now adjourned.